Welcome to Real Money Radio, the show that focuses on real people, real problems, and real solutions. Here's your host, certified financial planner, David Holland.
All right, welcome back. And we get to welcome back a returning guest. It's been a long time, but I'm very pleased to bring Heidi Richardson back on the line with us, global investment strategist for BlackRock. And it's a mouthful, but here it comes. Ready? BlackRockBlog.com. BlackRockBlog.com is the website. And Heidi's, I follow her work on LinkedIn and a lot of other places, and she just keeps putting out great articles. And one of her recent ones, which I thought was very relevant for where we are today with the markets and some of the things happening around the world, five reasons why you should consider investing in Japan. And I already warned Heidi that we might talk about a couple of other things because of her knowledge. And Heidi's managing director, head of investment strategy for U.S. iShares, part of the Global Investment Strategies and Insight Group. And they are big on macro and market insight, big with leveraging BlackRock's thought leadership program. And we'll be talking with Heidi because she's a big deal. She's got a lot of responsibility. She's on their investment team research and looking at a lot of the institutional and what financial advisor clients are looking at. And prior to joining the firm in 2010, 6 years at AllianceBernstein as managing director and senior portfolio manager. And she's covered a lot of markets, a lot of different areas. Of course, credential, CFA Society, and also the CPM designation, and a bachelor's from Bentley University. So, Heidi, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Listen, take me on the road, and I'll introduce you wherever you want me to go.
Okay, no problem.
You've got a great resume, and I love the work that you're doing. And I want to make the most of the time we have together and kind of dive in here. I know that you wrote recently about Japan back at the beginning of January about five reasons why investors still should consider Japan. And your article is just so timely because I've actually had people say to me, should I be getting out of Japan? They saw the negative interest rate movement, which is really a very rare event, going to negative interest rate. And the first question is, golly, if they're doing that, are things really bad in Japan? And should I have any money there? Should I be investing there in their stocks and their indexes? So let's start there. Should people be saying, hey, look, let's move away from this, or is there an opportunity?
No, well, I think it's really interesting if you look at it. We're talking about negative interest rates in Japan, but we've had negative interest rates in Europe for years, particularly looking at areas like Switzerland. If we even look at Germany, which you think of as the high quality reference for Europe, up until about 7 years in the curve, it's negative interest rates there. I think Japan gets a bad rap on the negative interest rate environment.
Why do you think that is? I mean, why would they get singled out? Is it just
I think because it's the first time that we've seen it in Japan. And we've had a great bull market run in Japan for the last few years. A lot of investors have had exposure in that region over the last, two, three, 4 years. Most of those have been on a hedged basis. And last year, we didn't see the yen move very much. It traded in a very narrow trading range. And now you see the yen actually appreciate 6% on a year-to-date basis. So I think that has people, a little bit nervous that there could be a further sell-off in equities. But I just think with some of this market volatility, we've seen this indiscriminate selling across the board in global equities with the flight to safety and quality, looking at things like treasuries and Japanese government bonds and gold and those types of things, that I think it's creating some even more attractive entry points for investors.
Excellent. I love that indiscriminate selling, because that's where the opportunity, of course, lies, is that people will just, and I just met with somebody, right here on the firing line. Here's out in the field what we're doing, Heidi. I met with somebody yesterday that said, oh, I just went to cash and now I need to figure out what to do. So if they had Japanese stocks, Chinese stocks, they had European stocks, they had U.S. stocks, it all went to cash because of a general kind of overwhelming panic or concern that may have, of course, as you are putting on the table kind of for Japan, may have eliminated some good positions or an opportunity to see some sort of rebound. And I also like what you said about the bull market that we've seen in Japan, and that has been driven a lot from their monetary policy up until this point.
Yeah, you know, and I think that if you think about the U.S. equity market and the bull market that we had in the U.S. equity markets, you know, there was quantitative easing one, quantitative easing two, quantitative easing three, adding all of this stimulus and really bringing the U.S. to a zero interest rate environment for an extended period of time. The Bank of Japan is doing something very similar in terms of trying to stimulate growth, right? There, with the negative deposit rate for excess reserves, it's really just punishing banks for not lending. Right? Yeah. They want them to go out and lend this excess money for new mortgages, for consumers to buy automobiles and those types of things. So it's not, you know, it's not a bad thing.
It's
actually meant to stimulate growth.
Yeah, it's not crazy. In fact, with all the political commentary about big banks in the United States not doing enough to do this, lend, you know, kind of tongue-in-cheek comment here. Maybe that's something we need to be doing here to make those darn banks lend that money, or we're going to, they have to, you know, we'll charge them interest if they won't do it. But you know,
well, there was a lot of talk about that when with Janet Yellen last week in her testimony to Congress.
Good point. Yeah, she did make that comment. I love whenever the policymakers say, look, we're not taking anything off the table. It's almost like when we're at war, they say, we're not taking anything off the table. We've got everything's ready to launch if we have to use it. So, all right, maybe one possible idea, and I'd like to get your take on this. It's really kind of a side comment, but it's a curiosity to me. It's the fact that it is new for Japan to go to the negative rates, but it also could be that the kind of the focus there is that they have had such a long running bout with, you know, low inflation or deflation, that it's kind of a funk they can't seem to wake up from.
Yeah, you know, it's been decades, decades of this deflationary environment. You know, I'm not as concerned. They're trying to reflate themselves out. Most central banks have a target of about 2% inflationary environments, whether you look at the U.S., whether you look at Europe, whether you look at the Bank of England and even the Bank of Japan. But the Bank of Japan isn't anywhere close to that 2% target. I think if you look at what they're doing from a policy measure, all of the reform going on with Abenomics as well, I think it's more important to get their economy to be more stable than to worry about what the pure number of inflation is. I don't think we're going to be in this truly deflationary environment that it stalls out the economy. Because if you think about why deflation is bad, it's because if you're anticipating prices going down, you're not spending the things you think it'll be cheaper in another week. So businesses don't invest and consumers don't spend. So I think as long as we see this environment for economic growth where it's been teetering with recession and popping out of recession, it's really been very volatile. Some quarters are negative, some are positive, but you know, it's moving in the right direction, I think, with the corporate reforms, particularly with the government and with Abenomics.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question, to talk about some of the corporate reforms. Let's do this. We'll grab a break and we'll come back, Heidi, and talk more about it. Heidi Richardson, ladies and gentlemen, global investment strategist for BlackRock. Website again, blackrockblog.com. Right back with Heidi. Stay right there.
Hello, I'm Brenda Campbell, General Manager at Volusia Memorial Funeral Home and Cemetery. Cremation is a choice that is chosen by many today. Our caring professionals will gladly work with you to plan cremation services and memorializations that fulfill your wishes and honor the life lived. At Volusia Memorial Funeral Home and Cemetery, we offer a wide variety of options, from urns for burial to many other choices. There are many ways to honor your loved one following a cremation. We can be reached at 386-673-5373 or our website, VolusiaMemorialFunerals.com. Volusia Memorial Funeral Home in Port Orange and Ormond Beach. Life well celebrated.
The Rice and Rose Law Firm is celebrating 30 years of service in Volusia and Flagler counties. I'm Paul Rice, President and Managing Partner of Rice & Rose. The Rice & Rose Law Firm has a department dedicated to estate planning, wills, trusts, and probate. We also provide legal guidance if you need a power of attorney, living will, or health care surrogate. Contact the Rice & Rose Law Firm at our Daytona Beach office at 257-1222 or visit our website at ricerose.com.
Are you looking for convenient, straightforward financial information? Just say no to superficial sales presentations. And yes to the free Real Money app. Get David Holland's new app for your smartphone or tablet. Just search Real Money with David Holland at your mobile device's store. You'll be able to access 17 educational TV shows, plus hundreds of radio shows and financial columns, all in the palm of your hand and on your schedule, so very easy and so very important to you. Again, to download the free app, search Real Money with David Holland.
Hey there, we're back. Heidi Richardson on the line with us, global investment strategist for BlackRock. And from her perch over at BlackRock and seeing the whole world as one big investment opportunity, we get to pick her brain a little bit and talking about her recent article, The Case for Investing in Japan, and we're kind of marching through some of the different advantages and justifications there. And we started to get into this before the break, Heidi. Now, really, I think it's something that a lot of people are not aware of. You know, we think of Japan being a very well-developed country, one of the bigger economies in the world. And they're not a new kid on the block, so to speak. So we naturally assume that they've got a lot of infrastructure and things that are kind of built out. And probably a lot of people assume that they're a lot like the United States in terms of how they have things structured. But one of the things you pointed to in your article was they're continuing to make corporate reform. So what does that look like? What are they doing? If you can maybe give us a little bit of an example or a little bit more flavor to that, what are they doing to try to really reform how they do those things?
Sure. There's a number of things. I think just first and foremost, looking at businesses, there's just been some unprecedented cultural shifts. And so allowing women into the workforce that were traditionally male-dominated jobs, having more women on boards, having more outside board members, those types of things that we've been doing here in the U.S., they're starting to do many of those measures. But I think looking at shareholder returns and what they're doing to try to improve some of the shareholder reforms, we've started to see them do more increasing dividends, doing share buybacks, more merger and acquisition activities. So all the things that we've been doing here in the U.S. that's been helping to draw attention to equity prices and stock prices, they're starting to do that in Japan. And if we look at the valuations of these companies, it's been really interesting. You hear in the U.S. marketplace about multiple expansion, and all that means is you have a price-to-earnings ratio. And if the price goes up but the earnings don't keep up, that multiple expands, right? Mm-hmm. So you're willing to pay a higher price for that same level in earnings. Well, in Japan, as the price has been increasing with the yen being so weak versus the U.S. dollar, it's been great for these exporters. And so their earnings have been increasing commensurate. So you don't see these stocks getting very expensive on a valuation metric. So I think that's really important is looking across the developed economy, with the quality of these earnings, people are looking at these stocks and they're still really attractively valued compared to Europe and the U.S. marketplace.
Mm, interesting. Now, you made a point earlier that I want to make sure I've got straight in my head. You talked about the yen has gotten stronger. You said it was up about 6% year to date?
Yeah, there's been some short-term volatility. Okay. Last year it didn't move very much, but this year we've seen some strengthening. It's off a bit today.
Okay. And so, yeah, and it's going to fluctuate, I know. I think that, one of the things that's very curious that we see these different currencies and how they trade against each other. And of course, the dollar has been getting stronger against some of our other trading partners and against other currencies around the world. And it's interesting that the yen has gotten stronger. And is that so much about the U.S. versus Japan, or is it more about Japan strengthening against other Asian currencies? And then by virtue of that, that's kind of given it a relative strength that has increased against the U.S. dollar.
Little of both. Okay. I think when you look at some of the devaluation that you've seen in China with the yuan, it's, you've got the yen appreciating versus the Chinese currency. I think when we look at the broad basket and compare it to the U.S. marketplace, I think a lot of what we've seen with the yen rallying is more of the flight to safety that investors are doing, right?
Okay.
So they're selling out of things like equities. And again, as I mentioned, just indiscriminately selling global equities, but they are buying government treasuries. And that's what's been driving for a period of time last week. You actually had 10-year Japanese government bonds with a negative yield, right? And that's something that we haven't seen.
Yeah.
If we look at today, it's actually down slightly, but it's still paying 0.04%, right?
Yeah,
so
right,
as we refer to it, 4 basis points in terms of yield.
Right. Interesting. Well, and now as we roll forward, if the U.S. does continue, even though it may be slower and not very significant rate increases, but as we unfurl this big sale of rates that may increase in the future, that will, of course, usually that means that gives strengthens a currency. And if Japan is going negative and we're going positive, could we see a reversal in that dollar strengthening? In other words, the dollar might start weakening against the Japanese yen?
No, actually, you know what? So the dollar has weakened this year versus the yen, but I still see the yen trending back in a weakening measure. So
okay.
Where it's trading
okay.
today at about 113, I see it at about 120.
Okay, all right. So we can see some strengthening of the dollar, continued strengthening of the, in other words, the yen might then kind of become more like what we've seen with the euro and some of the other currencies. And so that then, if the dollar gets stronger, that's going to make the and the Japanese yen is getting weaker at the same time, obviously, then that could also support the argument then, Heidi, about the exports from Japan being stronger because they're going to be relatively cheaper versus the dollar-denominated goods.
Exactly.
Okay.
And so I think
right.
in that case, U.S. dollar investors would want to have some hedged currency exposure.
Okay. I'm going to have an MBA by the time we're done with this. I'm trying to keep my mind straight about all this. But this is the point, of course, and this really, again, underlines your point about the indiscriminate selling that, you know, there's a lot of nuance to this. And of course, you know, neither one of us are going to tell people to go out and put all your money into any one area of the market or certainly not in any one stock or even maybe one country. But again, as is often said, Heidi, you know, there's nothing wrong with having the exposure to Japan and other countries that are part of an overall well-balanced diet, you know, well-balanced asset allocated portfolio, and it can be part of the allocation, especially as we see this continuing strengthening. And the thing that underscores all of this is a growing demand for Japanese stocks. And where is that coming from primarily, do you see?
Actually, I think that's one of the most interesting trends that we're seeing. And so if we looked over the last 2 or 3 years, many of the purchasers of Japanese equities were foreigners. So it was people in the U.S., it was Europeans, it was other Asians buying Japanese equities. What we've seen in the last year is really a fundamental shift where we've got domestic Japanese investors buying Japanese securities.
Mm.
And I think part of that was with the government pension plan doubling their allocation last year to Japanese equities, going from a 12% allocation to a 25% allocation. That plan's of $1.2 trillion in assets. I think that gave investors just the courage to step into equity markets. And then when we had the IPO for Japan Post, you know, one of the oldest, longest established companies in Japan, investors started thinking it's okay to actually own equities. And it's a fundamental shift from just owning savings and government bonds.
Well, that's a big shift because the more people we have, of course, we're demanding it. It's just going to broaden their base and really strengthen it. Beth's giving me the look that we need to take another quick break, Heidi. We'll grab a break and we'll come back, and I'd like to talk to you a little bit more about this and maybe some specific recommendations we might say if somebody does want a little bit of exposure and how they can do that with some of the BlackRock products. We could talk a minute about that. And then if we have time, I want to get to some other regions. Since we're already in the Far East, we might as well talk about a few other while we're there. If you're just joining us, Heidi Richardson's our guest today, global investment strategist for BlackRock, BlackRockBlog.com. Right back after this break.
Hi, I'm Teresa Rand with the Volusia Flagler YMCA. Our YMCA has 6 locations to help your family reach their health and fitness goals. The WISE Aquatics program is designed to teach personal water safety, stroke development, water sports, games, rescue, and personal growth skills. All participants are taught by our trained and certified YMCA aquatic instructors. For more information on how your YMCA can help with your health and wellness goals, check out www.vfymca.org.
Done right, done on time, or it's free. Holland Tax and Accounting Services, a division of Holland Financial, holds the same values our clients have trusted for almost 20 years. We have the financial expertise that will help you manage your business and personal financial priorities year-round, not just during tax season. Whether you are an individual or a business, Holland Tax can accommodate your needs for tax planning and preparation. For your business or personal finances, rely on Holland Tax and Accounting Services to deliver personal and detailed attention. Call 386-671-7526 to have your taxes done right, done on time, or it's free.
And we're back already because we've got more to talk about with Heidi Richardson, global investment strategist for BlackRock. And here's her website again, BlackRockBlog.com. And so much to talk about, Heidi. So if somebody's looking at their portfolio or working with their advisor and they say, you know, hey, let's be careful not to do some of that indiscriminate selling, and let's look at our country or our regional exposure, and maybe they decide they want to, you know, augment maybe an Asian and or more specifically Japanese exposure. Are there some BlackRock recommendations that we might want to take a look at?
Yeah, I think, you know, we have regional allocations that they can get exposure to all of the emerging Asian economies and the developed Asian economies. But one of the areas that I like to express Japan in particular is EWJ is the unhedged version of the MSCI Japan ETF. And then there's HEWJ, which is a hedged version. And again, currencies move over short periods of time. They can move, you know, very large. Just think about the beginning of this year. You know, we're about 6 weeks in. We've already seen a 6% shift in the yen. And I do think that that's going to trend back towards 120 instead of going down to 105. So in that shorter period of time, you'd want to think about having that hedge. But it's hard for investors to try to time the currency. So one of the products I like is something that we've launched just recently. It's an adaptive currency hedge. So we actually determine, based on the MSCI index, how much exposure you should have to hedged versus unhedged. And so that's DEWJ.
Okay.
And it takes the guesswork out for investors.
All right. So if you just can't get enough, there it is. You've got three versions of it, and that's good. A lot of options. So while we're in the region, we've already made the flight over to Japan. We might as well, you know, do some other sightseeing while we're there, Heidi. So let me just talk a little bit with you, if I could, just in terms of the region in general. Of course, as you very well know, so much has been focused on China with their quote-unquote potential hard landing. Talk to the listeners a little bit about what we mean by that with a hard landing. And, you know, they've had this economy that was just an economic just heavyweight. But that it's been slowing. Is it just that they aren't able to grow at this? They're still growing, and they've still been growing in terms of yuan or dollar values in terms of their growth. But because it keeps getting bigger, that same amount of growth is a smaller percentage? Or is it simply a smaller percentage growth rate because they just aren't growing as fast?
A few things. One of the things I think is first and foremost, the most important thing to take into consideration is if you think about China, it's the second largest economy in the world, and it's growing at about 6.5%. If we look at the U.S., which is the largest economy in the world, it's growing at about 2.5%. So you still have more than 2.5 times that type of growth that we're seeing in the U.S. You know, there's a lot of headlines, but calling that a hard landing, I wouldn't call it a hard landing. It's still tremendous growth in that region. But the government and the new leaders with Xi and Li, what they're trying to do is really reform that economy and try to have it be more consumer-driven like the U.S. In the U.S., 2/3 of our GDP is driven by the consumer. In China, it was a fraction of that. It was an investment-led economy. So what does that mean? That means you see episodes on TV about ghost cities and those types of things. Because if China was trying to have a target of a 10% economic growth rate and couldn't get there, well, the old leaders would build an airport. They'd build a bridge.
Right. Build it, they'll come.
Yeah, and so I think it's really important to say, you know, what they're trying to do to structurally reform it. And if they're growing at even 6% economic growth, that's going to be much more sustainable and real. I would prefer that than a 10% if I just go build something to try to hit that magic target.
Well, we'd love, of course, to have that here in the United States. I mean, we would be, you know, going crazy if we could get to, you know, 3 or 4. And you're right with the headlines about a hard landing. You know, that's, of course, how you sell papers and get people to stop and listen to your radio program or watch the news or whatever the case may be. You've got to have something that is, you know, attention grabbing. And the other thing that's been grabbing a lot of attention, of course, is with the slowing of the Chinese economy or the recalibration or whatever we call it, the repurposing of it, we'll call it that, is their demand for raw materials, oil, all of those things that have supported the surrounding developing countries who are very commodity dependent. And so that's had a major ripple effect. And of course, oil has been all in the news. And then that's rippled over, and that black gold has splashed onto our shores and caused us some challenges of oversupply. And that's led the market down.
You know, and I think that's a really important point. So two things that you just mentioned in that. One is the demand for commodities from China isn't there if they're not just building these ghost cities and the airports, right? So who does that impact the most? Well, that impacts areas like Brazil and these big commodity producers. Yeah. So I would be more worried about some of the Latin American economies than I would be about China slowing down. Yeah. But also, if we think about this low oil price, you just made a very, very important distinction. And while the news oftentimes reports that it's weak global demand and weak global growth that's causing this oil price to go down, it's actually oversupply, like you just mentioned. That's a big difference. It's that you have too much oil and too many producers. And now as you have Iran being able to produce, you have the U.S. and Mexico able to export more. You know, there's just too much oil driving this price down. It's not that demand has slowed. And I think that's really significant.
Well, thank you, Heidi. And I think the thing that's really kind of going to play into that, of course, now we're starting to hear calls and discussions about price freezes or production freeze. I should say not a price freeze, but a production freeze in a couple of countries. One of the one you mentioned, Venezuela, Russia, and I think it was even our good friend Saudi Arabia and then Iran is balking at a production freeze using January's production numbers just to try to slow the increase, not necessarily cut production, but just slow it.
Yep. And I think that that's what it's going to take. You know, I think there has to be some sort of disruption in the supply. Well, and an orderly disruption like that would be better than any other alternative.
Yeah, orderly is better. We don't need any of that uncertain stuff. Well, I've got a minute left, and I wanted to get your take on this because we've talked about oil. The conventional wisdom or thinking is that, you know, of course, we know that oil prices aren't necessarily good for the energy stocks, and we've seen that played out in the markets. But eventually, lower energy prices does help the consumer with more money left over after filling up the tank. So how long do you think it'll be before we see that benefit?
Well, you know, we've actually started to see it. We've started to see some improvement in some of the consumer discretionary spending and the spending from consumers.
Okay,
so while businesses have slowed a bit, you see more and more of a pickup. So I think it's generally a 12 to 18 month lag, and we're starting to see that.
Oh, great. Well, that's what I was looking for, because I've been telling people that, and they're like, well, how long is it going to take? I'm like, well, you know, it's going to be a while. I'm not sure. So that 12 to 18 months is a good number to have in my pocket to share with people. Great stuff, Heidi. I wish we had 3 hours, but that's it for a 30-minute show. Heidi Richardson, ladies and gentlemen, global investment strategist for BlackRock, blackrockblog.com. Great website, lots of resources. And Heidi, we'll have you back again. I loved it. I enjoy having you on, and you're a great resource.
Great. Thanks, David. Always a pleasure to be on your show.
Today's edition of Real Money Radio has been brought to you by Holland Financial, conveniently located on Granada Boulevard in Ormond Beach. Could you benefit from a one-on-one confidential conversation with David Holland, or would you like a second opinion to make sure that you're on the right track? Call Holland Financial at 671-PLAN or visit us at planstronger.com to schedule your no-obligation consultation. David looks forward to discussing the financial issues that matter most to you. The host of Real Money Radio, David Holland, is a certified financial planner with over 20 years of experience. And because David provides advice to clients on a daily basis, his hyperactive compliance department wants us to tell you that David Holland is an investment advisor representative of Holland Advisory Services, a registered investment advisory firm. He offers insurance and annuity products through Holland Insurance Services. Commentary given during this radio program should not be considered investment, insurance, tax, or legal advice. Views expressed concerning specific securities are not an offer to buy or sell. Investment advice and planning services can only be given after an analysis of an individual situation and only where Holland Advisory Services is registered or exempt from registering. Real Money Radio is produced by Holland Productions.